Today's program is proudly brought to you by Culture City, a for-purpose organization that provides a place of acceptance and support for all autism families. For more information, visit culturecity.org.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 151 of The Morning After. I am your host today, Sari Kamen. My co-host, Jessie Kiefer, is being held hostage by her employers. We miss her very much. Today in studio, the authors of the cookbook, Nopey. I have Chef Ramal Scully and chef and restaurateur and cookbook author of many other cookbooks, including Jerusalem, Plenty, Plenty More, Yoram Ottolenghi. Welcome to the show, fellows.
Thank you.
Hi,
Hi. Thank you for coming all the way from London just to be on The Morning After. I appreciate it
very much.
You're
very welcome, yeah. thanks for flying us over.
Oh,
yeah.
It's
first class.
Yeah, Aaron Fairbanks, the bill is on the way. I'm sure that's going to be totally fine. How is New York treating you so far?
Great.
So far, so good.
You have to say that, right?
Yeah. Always enjoy coming to New York City.
The chocolate chip cookies.
In America, in general? Have you had all of them?
We had most of them. We left a few.
Yeah.
Thank you. We appreciate that.
Yeah.
Before we get into talking with you guys about your new cookbook, Nopey, other stuff, I've got some food news to share. And if you'd like to chime in, if you feel like you can't suppress your emotions, please feel free. First, this is unfortunate. A dead mouse was found in a sandwich at Subway restaurant. Do you guys have Subway in London?
We have Subway. Yeah, we were talking about Subway.
Is it a place you eat a lot at?
No.
But now you will.
No.
Yeah. No, because we like mice.
But not necessarily in your sandwiches.
Sandwich, no.
So this is unfortunate. A customer in Oregon, in Lincoln City, Oregon, he ordered an Italian sub, and I guess a little extra meat came with it, because when he opened it, there was an entire dead mouse in the sandwich, and apparently it came when the person making, the sandwich artist, I believe is what they're called, was scraping the last of the spinach. Huh? And that came with it. Subway released a statement. They said, as soon as the customer alerted us about what happened, they were immediately given a full refund, which is great. And an investigation was launched. A thorough cleaning took place, and the health department gave the restaurant a clean bill of health. I feel really good about that.
How can a mouse slip into a sandwich? I mean, I could see an ant or a fly, or maybe even a little worm, but a mouse?
Yeah, you can definitely tell the difference between a mouse.
You would think it was covered in spinach.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, big spinach.
I think it's not a good look when the company slogan is eat fresh.
It wasn't a fresh mouse.
It was freshly dead.
Did the customer have a bite? They actually have a bite.
They didn't have a bite. Apparently he opened it up and just started laughing, because he was like, how did that happen?
It's like April Fool's Day.
Yeah, he's like, that is so disgusting. Yeah. Like, I just have to laugh. Okay, so moving on. Do you guys know about the Wu-Tang Clan? It's like a hip-hop.
Yeah, I do.
Of course. Amal's like, yeah, I do. I've been listening to Wu-Tang back since Australia. There's a new beer that's apparently, when it's being brewed, it's exposed. The only sound it's exposed to is Wu-Tang Clan. So now they're like marketing it as like a Wu-Tang Clan infused beer.
So what do you mean when you open the can? And he goes, what? It has like a.
It's like the essence of Wu-Tang.
No,
like
it's you don't hear it, but it filters the flavor.
Okay. It's like one sense
affects the other sense. What does that call?
Exactly, it's like when you play a baby like rock and roll in the womb, and your baby grows up to be a rocker.
Yeah,
but it's like it's a beer.
It's a beer. It's a baby beer.
So it's out in the market now. I can actually buy one.
You can buy it. It's from Philadelphia's Dock Street Brewery. Mm-hmm. The beer, as it fermented, listened to nothing but Wu-Tang Clan music for 6 months. So the result is a beer. It's a golden saison, and it's called the Dock Street Beer Ain't Nothing to Funk With.
Cool.
Get it? Like the other F word. Yeah, so that's weird. And then I have another beer story for you guys. You might be familiar with Beck's beer.
Yeah.
Where do you think it's from?
Beck's is Belgium? From Holland or Belgium.
Okay, so you could get $50, because anyone who thought that their Beck's beer was imported is now entitled to $50. A lot of people apparently thought that Beck's is German because it has German on it, and also the label says originated in Bremen, Germany.
But actually, the truth is
it's like made in St. Louis.
No.
So
we
yeah.
Can, so we can get $50 now?
You can get $50, but only if you have proof that you bought this beer, I guess sometime before like 2011, because some irate Beck's drinkers, they went to the court. They were under the, they said they were under the impression that their Pilsner was from a 130-year-old brewery, not a domestic brewery in St. Louis, right next to where Buzz Bud is.
So this is called like a class action or
that's
something
exactly.
Like this?
Yep. So to settle the lawsuit, Anheuser-Busch has agreed to pay $20 million to consumers total. And that means, I guess, if you people with proof that they made their purchase in a store could get up to potentially $50 per household.
Wow.
But, should, like, how many people keep their receipts from, like, when they buy a beer?
Oh, I do. I'm that kind
is that
of
right?
person. Yeah, yeah.
Are you
yeah.
serious?
No.
You could, but, you could quit the cookbook writing industry and
but
just cash
I do keep
in.
A lot of stuff that I really don't need.
Well, you should take a look.
But beer receipts, I don't think so.
Yeah, especially
I'll go have a look.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's it for our food news this week. Hope you enjoyed learning a little bit about American culture.
That's cool.
It's very
that's
fascinating.
Cool.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back talking more with you guys.
Cool. Great.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Culture City, a for-purpose organization that provides a place of acceptance and support for all autism families. This is Culture City's founder, Julian Maha.
Culture City was really born out of necessity. You know, it was born when my, currently six-year-old boy was diagnosed with autism. His name is Abram and he's nonverbal. And even though my wife and I were both physicians at the time, it was really hard for us to find any resources at that point to help him. All the other organizations out there that we know of, they do phenomenal work, but their main focus is basically finding a cure for autism. Our main focus is basically trying to prepare the community to accept not only children with autism, but their families as well. You know, in addition to that, we also want to provide help to these families in the here and now. You know, so tangible things like, you know, iPads for nonverbal kids, you know, financial scholarships, therapy scholarships, you know, art camps, and also some lecture series that can teach parents about, you know, dietary issues, you know, how to financially plan and things like that.
For more information, visit culturecity.org.
And we're back. You're listening to The Morning After. I am your host today, Sari Kamen. Jesse Kiefer is unfortunately not in studio today, but in studio today, I have chefs and superstars and magical people, Yotam Ottolenghi and Ramal Scully, which we will now only refer to as Scully because his mom... is the only person who's allowed to call him Ramal, and it makes him feel like he's in trouble.
Only when I get
in
trouble.
He's definitely not in trouble yet.
She's giving me that look, you know?
I give you the mom look. I'm like, yeah. I know what you're up to.
Yeah, definitely.
All the way from London, you guys are here. You're on this grand tour of your new cookbook, which is called Nopi, named after your restaurant, Nopi. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm saying that right?
Nopi, you can say Nopi or Nopi. It's up to you.
You just said the exact same word.
Nopi or Nopi?
Nopi.
No, that's different. Nopi.
Yeah. Nopi or Nopi.
Those are very different words.
Yeah, but yeah. But it stands for north of Piccadilly, so it's not a word.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so, you can say it as you like, really.
What does Soho stand for in London?
Soho in London stands for Soho.
Because here it's south of Houston.
Yeah, no, that's just always been Soho in London. It's Soho.
Right. Oh.
So what's it saying in here?
South of Houston.
South of Houston Street. Okay. But if you're not a New Yorker, you think it's Houston, like Texas. And we're like,
Is just too complicated.
Anyway, let's get back to the actual topic, which is Nopi. So that's your restaurant. Scully, you're the head chef. Yo, Tom, you're the co-owner and creator and all of that.
Yeah.
And so Nopi is like the combination of both of your sort of culinary influences. So other than Nopi, Yo, Tom, you have your other restaurants, the eponymous Ottolenghi's, which are like the expression of your flavors and, I don't know, just all of your culinary influences growing up, mostly, you know, in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. But Scully, you've brought your Asian background to the table, the literal and proverbial table here. So can you guys tell me a little bit about like how like the Ottolenghi way? I know it's like something you use to describe like your style of cooking. So like what's that? And then how did Scully?
Yeah, the Ottolenghi way is something that I've only figured out a few years ago because, it's a kind of a food language that Sami Tamimi, who is my another partner and a co-owner at Ottolenghi, and I developed over the years, and it means a lot of things, but essentially it's all those wonderful roasted and cooked vegetables and all those Middle Eastern flavors that are infused into all those vegetables, and it's a visual and culinary language that we've kind of developed over the years, and it's things like sumac and za'atar and roasted chicken with clementines and fennel and all those wonderful dishes that we both serve to our customers and publishing the books. And about 10 years ago, Scully came for a job in one of our restaurants as a kind of a evening chef, kind of sous chef or chef de partie. And his job was to create a little thing that we didn't do before, was it's a bunch of hot dishes to be served in the evening in the restaurant. So it's not the kind of deli takeaway style, but hot food. And Scully coming from Malaysia, he had a very different kind of flavors. A lot of Southeast Asian, quite a bit of Indian, a bit of Chinese, a bit of Malay. He's a big mixture. He's a big mongrel of a person.
Yeah, and definitely a mongrel mixer.
I've never had such lovely accents in the studio.
So Scully brought all these wonderful flavors. And for Sami and for myself, and initially it was quite difficult because we said, hold on a second, this is a Middle Eastern restaurant. This is like, we do tahini and we do chickpeas and we do bulgur. We don't do sambals. But Scully was quite persistent. And with his...
I pushed it.
And with his, weren't you intimidating?
Yeah. No, he's a very charming person. Yeah. So it's very easy to be drawn to his charms. And then over time, he just cooked his stuff. And then so it was kind of a little bit like a bargaining, like you do in the market. Go like, Scully, you can have one Asian dish on the menu. And he said, could I have two? And I said, okay, you can have two, but only today. So we've kind of had this negotiation, this conversation going on for the last 10 years until we opened Nopi about four or five years ago. And then he could actually do his own menu, which has some Asian flavors, but it's not an Asian restaurant. It's an Asian restaurant.
When me and Sami work together doing new dishes for Nopi, I always say, all right, let's make it, look at how many Asian dishes we got and how many Western dishes or how many Middle Eastern dishes. So we always make sure it's a good variety that basically shows my style of food and Yotam and Sami's culture and their food too.
And also often the dishes are neither here or there.
Yeah, maybe exactly. We mix and match.
We have, there's the chicken with the bread pudding and the peas. That's very European. It's almost French.
That's it.
So, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on there. But essentially, it's these two worlds, you know, his Asian culture and our Middle Eastern culture, which is at the core of the menu. You know, he loves to use miso and mirin and his...
But it is funny that tahini and miso does work.
Yeah.
So if you ever try, it's quite a cool combination.
Very nice. Yeah. And tahini and soy as well.
Yeah. I eat that like 7 times a day.
Yeah, exactly. Love you look like that kind of person.
I actually ate at Nopi this past summer.
Is that right?
I did. Ah. That's wrong.
And we didn't know.
Yeah.
I know. That was so crazy. You guys didn't come over and like make a big deal about it.
No.
But no, I mean, like, as someone who was just eating there, and I didn't have the cookbook yet, so I hadn't read the whole story, I didn't feel like any of the dishes were like aggressively one way or the other.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they were all just like delicious sounding things.
And that's the main thing we always look for, big bold flavors.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, those spices sound amazing together, but it wasn't categorically like, oh, I'm going to have one Asian dish and then...
No. I mean, we have a dish here for quail, and it's got a miso butterscotch sauce, and then it's got this salsa made out of pomegranate seeds and pickled walnuts and sherry vinegar. So it's a real kind of mixture. It makes complete sense in its own right, although it includes components from various parts of the world. It doesn't really matter these days so much as it used to do in the past. That kind of ideal, I mean, the idea of authenticity in kind of middle of the road restaurants. It's not a middle of the road restaurant. That's not the right term, but in kind of modern restaurants.
It's really kind of like a truck stop sort of place in the middle of Soho.
in modern restaurant is something that is very... It doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody mixes and matches in a way.
Right.
I mean, you can take it quite far, actually.
Yeah, and I just want to talk about that authenticity and ingredients, Vera, a little bit. I saw you guys speak last night at the 92nd Street Y, and hummus came up as like, you know, this sort of like ubiquitous thing that everybody has. And I mean, I guess, Yotam, I'm sort of curious, like, are you just sitting around laughing like, you idiots, hummus has been around forever? Like, good job, like, discovering that and like making it a trendy thing. And at the same time, I mean, you have this way of like using food as a way to kind of approach peace, maybe. I mean, like, your work with Sammy, the way you bring together this like Palestinian Israeli sort of influence, and talk about like how you have these dinners where people from all over, you know, all different sort of backgrounds and histories. I mean, can hummus make peace? Is that the goal?
Chickpeas. Sorry, more seriously, hummus cannot make peace, but what it can do is what you get when you sit together around a table with people of, you know, opposing sides of a conflict. Food is a great diffuser. So food is the one thing that you can sit around and enjoy and completely not take sides in any kind of immediate conflict.
Except like if you want more or less.
Yeah, or except like if it's coarse hummus, which is terrible, because that's Greek. Or if it's smooth tahini, which is great because that's Arab. That's
Scully,
the right way. That's the right way.
No, I'm not saying that. Don't even go there, Scully.
It needs to be very smooth. No, but more seriously, when you sit to people around a table and they enjoy a good meal, it's a very good starting point for a conversation. And conversation is what we need. So food will definitely be a starting point for any kind of situation where people would agree to sit and talk. But first they need to agree and sit and talk. And unfortunately, that's not happening at the moment in Israel and Palestine. It's just all terrible. Yeah.
It's a good point because, like, you know, hummus is a sharing kind of dish.
Yeah.
You know, you sit down, you share, you have great conversations.
Yeah. And all that style of food is.
Yeah. You take the pita, you break it in two. One half for me, one half for you. That's how you start the meal. Yeah. I mean, that's a very symbolic act.
Exactly. I think no one can sit down by themselves and just eat a platter of hummus. You could probably die.
I can.
I'm talking to the wrong people.
Maybe two. It's a bit like your ramen. I mean, you could have two bowls. I can have two bowls.
Yeah. Well, maybe. I'm watching these guys eating pizza and I'm thinking tahini on top. That'll be really cool.
Tahini on everything.
Yeah, tahini pizza.
I put it in oatmeal.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Oh, no, oatmeal, that's great.
Very peaceful.
Yeah.
Like, she tried tahini and spread it on top of fish and baking in an oven.
Yeah.
It's really nice.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's so nice.
Why don't you come over and make that later?
You don't need to ask me twice.
Yeah, don't start.
Scully is such a nice man. As soon as you ask him to do something for you, he just comes and does it.
Oh, no.
He always cooks in everybody's parties, in everybody's weddings, in the company.
Few,
he goes, like, haven't you? There's something.
Yeah, I've done a few for the staff. And I could never say no, because it's food, you know? I'm like, why not? I'd love to share my knowledge to you guys.
Well, it's funny that you say that about Scully, because, you know, one thing that really struck me about this cookbook is the whole introduction is all about your feelings about Scully. And I kind of love that. Like, the whole thing is like, let me tell you about my friend Scully. And, you know, it's wonderful because
it's a romance
story.
It's
a rom-com. It's great because we didn't know Scully personally, you know, in the way that we knew you with Jerusalem and Plenty and all of that. But why did you choose to spend so much time and like make so much of the cookbook devoted to us learning about Scully?
Because I had to introduce the person who is really the creator of most of these recipes. I mean, the way we work is that Scully at Nopi comes up with ideas and then he shares them with Sammy and with me, and then we get our bit to add to the equation. But he's the originator of most of the ideas in the book. So I had to say, come on, guys, this is the new kid on the block, and I really need to introduce him and his food heritage, because that explains quite a lot of the food. And I think, I'm sure, it's not a thought, I'm absolutely positive that food really these days needs a context. Mm-hmm. Recipes are so abundant. I mean, you open your computer or your smartphone and you Google something, you get a recipe like in 2 minutes. But the stories, how this happened, is what really people need to know before they start mm-hmm. cooking. So if I'm going to include all those recipes in a book, I need to tell where this has started. And this is the story of Scully's collaboration with me and how and his background and his love of food. So I needed to do that before we could start saying, okay, so that's Scully's butterscotch miso and that's my pomegranate seeds and that's how it came together.
Every time you say butterscotch miso, my mouth is just like, it just starts salivating.
It's an awesome way to use miso and burn the shit out of it, you know, and then you get that natural caramelization.
Yeah, why don't you come over later and make that?
That's actually a yes for me now.
It's two yeses, good. Yeah.
Christina Tosi, right?
Yes.
I
learned that from a dessert from what she did on Lucky Peach. Yeah. And I remember taking that recipe and doing it in the kitchen when I figured out what it really was. And I was just jumping around. I'm like, check out these new flavors, man. We miss it. And my chef's like, what the fuck? You know, what are you doing? You know,
you can swear.
So, but to mix, with, you know, your times, like that salsa was a famous roasted eggplant dish we did in the restaurant. Pomegranates, pickled walnuts, pomegranate molasses, and a bit of olive oil really works well with the miso. And you know, this is like new food kind of trend. Like, it did work. You know,
it worked really well. Yeah.
I love it. It's like Scully, you're like the Wizard of Oz, like the man behind the curtain. So you guys talked last night, when I saw you speak, that some of the dishes at Nopi, if you take them off, people have actually rioted.
Sent you hate emails.
What are some of those dishes that like you can't mess with anymore?
One of them is the blue cheesecake. And it kind of relies me that, you know, after all these years cooking, like, you know, that when you have a great dish in your restaurant, you just leave it on. It's a great staple dish.
Yeah.
You know that recipe works. It does not fail. And people keep coming back for that specific dish. It's
every restaurant. I think sometimes you want to change recipe just for your interest as a chef, but actually customers want that kind of reassurance that they go into a place and they'll find their favorite thing.
Yeah.
And the cheesecake is definitely one of those. And when we say cheesecake, it's not a sweet cheesecake. It's a savory. Yeah. It's a bit like a blue cheese souffle with a crust on the bottom, like you have at the bottom of a cheesecake.
And it's got pickled beetroots on top, and then drizzle some thyme honey infused on top. So the honey, the richness of the blue cheese and the pickled beetroots really work well.
Yeah, it's really nice.
Another one I can think of.
He can go to your house later.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to be able to pull that one off. I need your help, Scully.
No, okay. Another one is the twice-cooked baby chicken with the chili sauce and the lemon salt that goes on the side. That's been there since day one. So it's amazing that simple chicken dish sells crazy every night. So.
If for those of you out there, don't read this book on an empty stomach.
Mm. Yeah.
Because you will start eating your own hand. You will become so ravenous.
Or the pages.
Yes, yeah. Or that. And that would be unfortunate.
Or make sure you have a bowl of hummus next to you when you read it.
Yeah. So this cookbook is restaurant food, but you guys have tweaked it a little bit for home cooks.
We wanted to. When I said to Scully a few years ago, let's do this book, we'd have very different ideas about what this book is going to be like. Scully imagined one of these Noma cookbooks, you know, that like nobody cooks from.
It's
like four pages for a recipe that takes 7 years to make and with all
you
the
get marinades. That one for the picture.
Yeah.
And it's for the pictures and for the chefs that want to be inspired for this. But I said, no, Scully, we're making a cookbook for cooks to cook at home, because that's what my books are like. And Scotty felt like, oh, that's really easy.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be a walk in the park. And I have to say, it's one of the hardest things.
It was a very long park.
hardest thing I did in 21 years cooking.
Like finding ways to make to kind of simplify.
Number one, I had to learn how to measure salt. So that's pretty straightforward.
I know, because you guys are on the metric system. Yeah. That's freaky.
Yeah, and then the first 6 months, I was, you know, having a restaurant, you have suppliers of bringing great ingredients and great vinegars and dressings. You know. So in the first six months, I was bringing a crate to the test kitchen, New York Times test kitchen, and bring all my special kind of sauces. And the other time's like, look, you can't find this. You have to find ingredients you can find in supermarkets. So I had to learn, like, teach myself to be like a home cook in a way that go to supermarkets, shop for the ingredients. But the one thing we have achieved is to get that same flair as what we do in OPU restaurant, to get it in the home wise, in the home kind of cooking, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a great achievement.
So, yeah, so we needed to take all these wonderful flavors and make sure that people can actually go home and cook them. Even though some of the recipes are not simple to make in the sense that they take time, they're all very doable.
Yeah.
There's nothing like a crazy technique or ingredient that you can't get your hands on.
Exactly.
It's geared for home cooks.
And another important thing I had to like teach myself, if I was cooking at home for friends, you know, number one, you know, you want to prepare your meal, and then your guests will come, so you want to make sure your kitchen's clean, you dress, and you're mingling with your guests, and then all you need to do is reheat the food. And I had to think, what's the best way to efficiency to reheat some of these dishes? We're not making more mess and more pans, you know, like in the kitchen. I've got kitchen porters, so I can just throw a pan and you bring another one. You get my point? So
What kind of dishes do you guys cook at home? I mean, not from the cookbook, but like if maybe by yourself, or you know, with your family.
Yeah, I have like this thing that I like to make. I can make it like once a week, which I make the simplest tomato sauce, and I add three tins of smoked oysters with the oil.
Wow.
And I put it over pasta or couscous or something.
Yeah.
It's like the best thing in the world. Do you eat smoked oysters?
Oh, every day. With tahini and miso.
I thought so.
For breakfast.
You got a great pantry, it sounds like, in your house.
Yeah,
you should come over and see it, and then maybe cook while you're there.
And then you can cook something for her.
Just like while you're there, you know.
Yeah, why not?
Just
there. Yeah, so that's, for me, that's the most immediate thing, and everybody loves it. I mean, those oysters are amazing. You should get some for your pantry.
But you have another one, too. You always say you like cooking an omelet with the oysters. Is it oyster omelet?
Oyster omelet. That's more like... that oyster omelet is Asian. That's quite complicated. Yeah. You need to make you need to make this... The water with the... with corn flour to get these, you need to get little lumps in your egg mixture before you add your oysters, because that's more work.
Yeah.
And you need an Asian salad next to it because it's very rich.
Yeah, I get you.
So that's not the end of the day.
Don't skip on the Asian salad. But you get the smoked oysters just in the tin that you get at the
just
grocery store.
Any kind smoked oysters in oil, and you make your tomato base like you do any pasta sauce. Tomato base sauce. You throw two of those in, a bit of chopped cilantro, and you're in heaven.
Go on.
For me, it depends on the day itself. Like if I feel like being healthy, I like to bake a salmon in the oven, then I flake the salmon and I put a bit of spinach, watercress, dukka for crunch, you know, a bit of ginger, and that's like being healthy day. But if I feel like I'm just lazy and I couldn't be bothered picking up a pot, I'll just boil some water and pick my favorite 2 minute noodles, put in a bowl, water, and then a raw egg and some leaves. So that's my indulgence sometimes. Yeah.
That sounds really nice.
And when you buy 2 minute noodles, there's better ones and worse ones. So you need to get the brand.
Good brands.
Like.
Yeah, and I like the brand that you actually have a packet of like the saturated oil, and like you get the seasoning on the side.
Yeah, the chili oil.
That's one.
Do you guys have any particular dishes that you really miss from like your childhood, or you know, from your respective countries, that for whatever reason, like it's not as easy to recreate in London?
Yeah. For me, I think it's mum's curries. You know, she's only got a set recipe. That's why I could never pull it off how she does it, and she just cooks how she feels. And I think it's more the childhood memory that when she comes down, I make sure she comes into my house and does a big, you know, little cook off, and me and my flatmates, and I enjoy her curries.
So that's the one time you don't cook.
Yeah, exactly.
She comes over.
I have to wash up, so.
Isn't it true that certain flavors that you have when you're growing up, you can never recreate? Yeah. I mean, yeah. You can never really... Like, I always tell Scully about my grandmother's gnocchi alla romana, which is just semolina, dumplings.
Yeah. We used it in an upper street restaurant a couple of times. Yeah.
But it never lived up to my memory because it was just, they were so pillowy and light and just a bit of cheese on top. It was like the most beautiful thing. And as much as I've tried to recreate it, and I'm actually doing a column now for The Guardian on gnocchi, so I know I'm going to try again.
It's never going to work.
Is there anything that you can't get in London that you can get in the markets in Jerusalem? Yeah.
It would be more, it's not going to be the ingredient itself, but more like the quality. So you're going to have a couple of North African dried chilies that you can't get. It would be probably certain nuts of really, really fresh almonds.
I bought a new herb that last year that I got introduced called za'atar, the tips of wild thyme, because you get it so fresh.
The real za'atar.
Yeah, the real za'atar.
You just found out about za'atar.
No. This is actually the fresh herb. It's tips of wild thyme.
It's za'atar leaves that have been dried out. So it's not like this powder that you spread. And you can rehydrate it. You can put it in breads, etc. So it's actually za'atar leaves. Because za'atar is a dried leaves made into a powder. But in Israel, in Palestine, you can get it like completely dry. Or you can get it even fresh, or you can pick it. Yeah. But what he was trying was just the dried, and then you can do lots of it.
Yeah, what do you get in London? Like a supplier gave it to me in a jar, and they usually, because it's hard to bring in fresh, but they just like lightly brine it in salt water. So you still get the fresh flavor of the za'atar. And it reminds me like a really fresh, rich oregano. So I love using it. And I think one of the combinations of it was oyster mayonnaise, poached mackerel and burnt butter, and a quick sour cabbage sauerkraut to go with the za'atar.
So Yotam, I consider you to be the vegetable whisperer.
So I
would love to hear your predictions, both of you, of like what's the next big vegetable.
Okay,
because
okay.
for a while, you know, it was kale. I don't know how it was in the UK.
Yeah,
but
kale.
It was like kale, and then they're like, oh, Brussels sprouts, and I think it's cauliflower now. Maybe?
Cauliflower.
So what's going to be 2016?
Cauliflower is a bit 2014, but at least I know. Dated. I think the root vegetables are coming back big time. The celery root, the turnip, the swede. You don't call it swede, you call it rutabaga. Those are really making a big comeback.
Basically, once you decide it, that's what it is.
Well, you've heard it here first.
We've heard it here first.
Now, more like the fact that people are discovering slow cooking. And they have been, I've been doing it, Scully's been doing it, and other chefs have been doing it, taking all those roots, sticking them in the oven for like 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours, and coming, and they're coming out with all the sugars like pumped up like naturally from the slow cooking, and you can do so much with it. So you can blitz it and mash it, and you can turn it into a sauce or dressing. You can cut it literally. We've got in this book, in the Nopi cookbook, we've got a whole celery root that's cooked with some seasoning, olive oil, salt and pepper, and wrapped in foil, and then thrown in the oven for 3-4 hours, and then you can literally cut a wedge and eat it with the skin and everything, and it's the most delicious things. So I think it's not so much discovering new vegetables, because I don't think there's any more to discover now. They're just going to develop new ones, but I think it's much more about learning what to do with those old vegetables that we know. And in Plenty More, which was my previous book, it was all about techniques, like what do you do with that same old cauliflower in all sorts of different contexts, whether you braise it or you grill it or you steam it or you just eat it raw, etc.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So are there any plans on the horizon right now as far as like another Nopi, maybe opening in New York or, more Odolenghi than you are?
For me right now, after the books come out, I'm still working on dishes for the November-December menu's done. So I'm always working for new dishes for next year. So give you example, I've just bought a shitload of crab apples, green peaches.
That's a technical term.
Yeah.
A measuring.
Large
metric.
Quantities of like, and I love my pickling, so I'm getting ready for January, February, Wednesday, March menu. But on my side, just keep creating, keep doing new dishes, and keep pumping those vegetables out for your time. So
We've got another book on the horizon in a couple of years' time. So that's already been working, and it's going to be a sweet book. So cakes and desserts. And yeah, those restaurants, you need to keep on nurturing them and make sure the food is still good.
What would it take to get you to come over here and do a restaurant?
Someone that would come and pay first class tickets for us every week.
Okay.
And to come and taste the food and see everything is done.
Sam Cass said he'd send you a weekly email, and I was like, that's lame. I mean,
Make more effort. Raise the stakes. Anyone can email you.
Yeah.
Those teleport machines.
For I'm you thinking like ship I Roberta's mean, pizza.
Sam Cass is very charming.
Duh.
But
I can see by your face.
I mean, whatever. He's okay. I don't care.
But yeah, no, it's complicated. But yeah, maybe it could happen. It could still happen that we'll have a place in New York. Who knows?
Yeah. Well, you always have a radio show to come to. You guys, thank you. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back with the morning after quiz. So get scared.
Cool. Cheers. Thank you very much.
Hi, this is Dave Arnold from Cooking Issues, and I'm here to talk to you about the Museum of Food and Drink, which is finally getting a brick-and-mortar space right here in Brooklyn, New York. So the Museum of Food and Drink is opening the MOFAD Lab, our first laboratory and gallery space, where we will be putting on an exhibition called Making It or Faking It, the History of the Flavor Industry. It tackles a very important topic, which is how the food system got to be the way it is now as a result of the intervention of the flavor industry, how that happened. Get your tickets at tickets.mofad.org to come see the first exhibit ever of the Museum of Food and Drink at the MOFAD Lab, brought to you by Infinity on 62 Bayard Street.
And we're back. You're listening to The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org. I am in studio with Yotam Odolenghi and Chef Scully. Scully.
Yeah, it's right.
Scully. And it is time for the TMA quiz. Now, okay, you guys, this is going to be a multiple choice quiz.
Okay,
cool.
I'll give you three possible answers, and then you choose the one that you think is right. There's three questions.
Okay.
And like I said, it's totally irreverent. Like, I hope that, you know, it's funny to you. One person has won the quiz ever, gotten all three. So
really?
We'll see how you do. No pressure. Ooh. Okay. Yotam, Scully, you know a lot about Nopi, your famed restaurant in London, and your new cookbook by the same name. But what do you know about Nopi National Car Shows, the massive automotive events that have been taking place in various cities across the U.S. since the late 1980s? Let's find out. Okay, number one. The very first Nopi show began in a car parking lot in 1988 and featured only one brand of car. Was that brand a Porsche, B, a Volkswagen, or C, a DeLorean?
Ooh. I'm going to say a DeLorean.
Oh.
Because I've never heard of that.
DeLorean was the car they used in Back to the Future,
which was
in 1985. And yesterday... Did you know it was Back to the Future, Jay?
So it's probably not the right answer.
Oh, yeah, I kind of blew through that.
We'll say B.
Okay,
let's B go. Is Volkswagen and A is a Porsche.
Let's go for B, Volkswagen.
What do you think, Philly?
It's a car website with naked girls kind of stuff. I'll go for the Porsche.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, it was actually B Volkswagen. Cool. First car show. Okay. The Nopi Car Show events are not just about looking at cars, as Scully just revealed if you were aware. Other entertainment includes A, jello wrestling, B, wet t-shirt competitions, or C, hot dog eating competitions.
I'm definitely not going for B.
B for me too.
You are going for B.
Yeah, B.
Yeah, B.
That might have been true, but it was actually jello wrestling.
No, are you serious?
Yeah, I didn't see anything about. I mean, I saw the bikini shows.
Volkswagen and jelly wrestling.
Like peanut butter and jelly. Damn. Just go hand in
gorgeous.
Hand.
Gorgeous. Yeah.
You can't drive a Volkswagen without jumping in some jello first.
Wow.
Okay, last one.
Only in America.
Maybe.
Sorry.
Maybe. I can't prove that. Okay, each national show involves a series of car competitions in different categories. Which category name was not actually part of a Nopi show? A, high rollers, B, straight flush, or C, deuces wild wheels? I'll repeat that for you. A is high rollers, B, straight flush, or C, deuces wild wheels?
I say high rollers wasn't.
Okay.
I'll mix it up. I'll get B.
Okay, well, actually, unfortunately, you guys were wrong.
Yeah.
The only one that wasn't a real one was Deuce's Wild Wheels.
So you just made that up?
Yeah.
You are so creative.
Oh, my God, thank you. Thank you, Odalini.
So we got it all wrong. I got it
you
all wrong.
You got one wrong. Yeah. You got Volkswagen wrong.
Ah, okay, and Scully got
it
wrong.
I got all wrong.
Yeah. But you know what? I didn't expect you to. You knew more than I expected.
They are hard questions.
They're very hard.
That's how you do them.
You have to be a special kind of genius to know these answers.
Yeah, fairly good on that.
You know what, you guys? I think you don't quit what you're doing. You're great at cooking. You really both have promising futures.
Thank you. Well, we'll see.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll see how it works out.
Yeah. Time will tell.
Yeah. Well, maybe after this radio show and your name gets
something
out.
Something starts
Yo, Tom Scully, I just cannot thank you enough for being here. It just means so much to us that you stopped in our little shipping container in Bushwick.
That's really cool. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. How can we find Nopi the Cookbook?
Well, you can find it online in every good...
The internet. Great. Yeah.
And in good bookshops around the corner from you.
Yeah. And do you guys have any like websites or Twitters or things like that that you want to... say
no.
Google Otolenghi.
Google Otolenghi, or follow Otolenghi or Chef Scully on Twitter.
Yeah,
or Instagram.
I'm quite new in the social media thing, so you have
to be
pushing
it up.
Yeah, I'm training him. So it's Scully at Chef. Scully Chef.
Yeah,
at Scully
Chef. And if you happen to find yourself in London, eat at Nopi in Soho. It
absolutely
is one of the best meals of my life. I know it will be yours
Or Otolenghi.
Or a link. Or both. If you're smart, both. All right. Thanks, guys. Thanks for listening to The Morning After on Heritage Radio. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.